Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Western Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov was welcomed by his South African counterpart for talks in Pretoria. Now, Western media have called South Africa's welcoming of the Russian diplomat somewhat controversial, yet it neglected to mention that South Africa has refused to condemn Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. Why has South Africa done so? Or maybe the broader question should be, why have certain African countries warmly greeted Russia while resisting the West, like the U.S. or France for that matter, like in the case of the Burkina Faso? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how African countries have embraced Russia and also China over Western countries, especially the U.S. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the Spotlight. Abiyomi Azikiwe, editor at the Pan-African Newswire, joins us from Detroit. Also joining us is Netfa Freeman, coordinating committee member at the Black Alliance for Peace, who joins us from Washington, D.C.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Abiyomi Azikiwe, let me first start with you. Taking a look at this visit by the Russian foreign minister to South Africa. Now, when you take a look at the headlines, it depends which ones you're reading. The Western ones are saying that this visit has sparked criticism because of its backdrop to the Ukraine special military operation by Russia. Yet you have the reality, which is what has been stated by the South African foreign minister in terms of thanking Lavrov for, quote, the most wonderful meeting after the talks that were held, which she earlier had said would help strengthen the already good relations between the two countries. What are we looking at when it comes to the way that this piece of news has been covered, first of all?
Well, thank you so much. First of all, South Africa has committed itself to a position of non-alignment, along with the majority of the African Union member states, some 55 governments. Also, South Africa has urged the United States, as well as Ukraine and the Russian Federation, to engage in negotiations to end the Russian special military operation in Ukraine. Historically, even prior to the formation of the Russian Federation during the days of the Soviet Union, there was very close relations between various African states and the USSR. So this is an historic relationship, and irrespective of what the United States is saying, that South Africa should not have cordial relations with the Russian Federation or the People's Republic of China, they are not considering that in regard to their foreign policy. There's going to be joint naval operations between the Republic of South Africa, the People's Republic of China, and the Russian Federation coming up very shortly. So the relationship appears to be strengthening. That, of course, is going to be impacted as well because South Africa is taking over the chairmanship of the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa organization, the BRICS Summit, this year. So the relationships between these countries, South Africa, China, and the Russian Federation, seems to be strengthening irrespective of the opposition by the United States.
Why does the U.S. feel, Netva Freeman, that it can tell South Africa not to strengthen its relation with Russia? Why would it feel that it can even say that or act on it and make that type of a request from another country?
This posture is a posture of one of his historical legacies and historical ties, but it's also a posture of desperation. As historical ties, this is really what the U.S. does. This is how foreign policy is around the U.S. It's a full-spectrum dominance foreign policy. It's about bullying and telling countries what to do, not just South Africa, but other countries. And so even this is also the U.S. foreign policy is based essentially predicated on domination, what we refer to as a gangsterism. And it's been able to exert its influence over countries in Africa and other countries through International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and certain things and the World Trade Organizations. And now they're finding their position in the world, particularly the global economy, is waning. They don't really have anything else to offer but a gangsterism and a militarism. So they're really militarizing the world. They've scattered their militarization, the military bases, and Africa, the U.S. Africa Command across the continent. And so it feels like it can do this because, one, it feels like it has to do it because it has no other choice, and that it feels it stems from the legacy and the inheritance of the Western colonialism across over Africa, and their prior even support when it comes to South Africa, their prior support in, or should I say, leanings toward apartheid, the settler regime before apartheid was decimated. So I mean, was abolished. And even when we think about it, people don't generally think of the U.S. as a settler colonialism, but it is settler colonialism. So they have the affinities that way. That disposition is inherent for them, and that's just how they feel about things and the posture it takes.
Right.
And again.
Right. Well, that type of posture, Abiyomi Ezekiwi, doesn't that go against the supposed interest that the U.S. has in Africa? I mean, it comes out, for example, saying about the naval exercises that they're supposed to have, South Africa with China and Russia, I believe, that they're disgraceful and tantamount to a declaration that South Africa is joining the war against Ukraine. I mean, if U.S. has interest in establishing good relations with African countries, that type of approach just shoots itself in the foot. Why does it continue down this path?
Well, as Netva just stated, it is a act of desperation. We've seen the debates over the last few days in regard to the supply of battlefield tanks that are produced in NATO countries, German tanks, perhaps the Abrams tanks that are supplied by the United States. And there's a huge difference of opinion around this question. And why is this? Because the United States has been misleading people in regard to developments in Ukraine, both within Ukraine itself as well as internationally. And to the credit of South Africa, they have maintained their position of non-alignment. They want a negotiated diplomatic solution to the situation in Ukraine. Lavrov mentioned yesterday during his press conference with Dr. Naledi Pandor that in the early stages of the special military operation, which began last February, that there were the possibility of ending the conflict diplomatically. But the United States, as well as the European Union and other NATO countries, ensured that Ukraine would not negotiate in good faith to bring the conflict to a amicable resolution. And the longer they continue to supply weapons to Ukraine and military assistance and diplomatic cover, this is going to continue. More and more Ukrainians are going to die. Right now, the United Nations reported that there are approximately 8 million refugees that have fled Ukraine. So the NATO countries are in a very desperate situation right now to try to rope in other geopolitical regions of the world to support their position, not only in Eastern Europe, but also in the Asia-Pacific region as well, in West Asia, along with the African continent itself and Latin America.
Okay, let's rewind. Go back to the year 2017. And let me ask you, Netva Freeman, back then, the a Security Council official by the name of John Bolton, which I'm sure you're aware of who he is, This is what he said. He said the U.S. plans to counter the rapidly expanding and added China to the mix, Chinese and Russian economic and political influence in Africa, which U.S. was blamed for, not blamed for, but U.S. was just one step behind when it came to China and Russia vis-a-vis Africa. And it said that they are rapidly expanding their financial and political influence. And it said that they're deliberately doing that because they want to gain a competitive advantage over the U.S. So it's okay for the U.S. to do that, but not for Russia and China?
Well, I mean, the U.S. operates, I mean, this leadership, the leadership of the U.S. operates on double standards. It just has that double standards. We can actually see, go back even a little further to the establishment of AFRICOM, which we talked about earlier, the U.S. Africa Command, that this, the putting together of this, the more coordinated actions and the strengthening of military on the African continent is also a response to China. I mean, it shows that those were one of the things that they were concerned about. And in China being now the largest trading partner with Africa, this in the United States, not really, its trade relations are predicated on colonial type relationships, the naked extraction of raw minerals and other things out of, and then cash crops and exploitation of labor, and then selling back finished goods. So it doesn't really have the type, they can't offer the type of things in terms of trade relations that China is offering. That we can speculate with China's reason, political reasons. Nations have political reasons for doing things, but we also have to remember that China is also a formerly colonized country. So despite where it looking for its own, exercising its own interest in politics, it also has a purview that is a little bit more, that is more in line with those who have been colonized. So when we look at the Belt and Road Initiative, it establishes much more bilateral relationships. It's just forgiven 27 loans to 27 different African countries. The United States and the Western powers don't operate this way. Because of them, they're traditionally being colonialism, now emerging as neo-colonial powers. They can't understand why their disposition in the world is waning, and so they're trying to grasp that. And we can see that why when they just invited a lot of African leaders in December to Washington, this last December in Washington D.C., they're trying to see if they can adopt some of the means, the strategies or strategies that China has adopted. But at the same time, they're not really equipped to do that. The United States doesn't really manufacture things anymore. Its riches are based on finance capital as opposed to goods, and it just has very little to offer, aside from weapons. It's the biggest weapons deal in the world. Uh-huh. And so this is what they're faced with.
Sure. Well, let's see here. When you were talking about that, it came to my mind, Abiyumi, as it came to me, a situation that somewhat parallels this in a sense, where the U.S. Wants to gain a foothold or footing in Africa, but the stated the real intention behind that is to counter the growing influence of China and Russia. And this kind of parallels what it's doing in the South China Sea area when it comes to trying to take countries out of the orbit of China and bring it into its own sphere. But the goal is something that, for example, ASEAN countries are not very favorable to when that is the kind of goal that the U.S. has. Is it okay to put a comparison in that respect, and that, of course, that kind of objective is doomed to fail?
Yeah, I think it is a fair comparison. The United States has been deeply involved in African affairs, African history, since the 15th century. Well, Europe has since the 15th century, and the United States has since the 17th century, vis-a-vis the Atlantic slave trade. The U.S. was also in attendance at the Berlin Conference in 1884 and 1885. They supported all of the reactionary colonial regimes that had enslaved people on the continent all the way into the 20th century. They supported the racist apartheid regime in South Africa. They supported the Portuguese colonialists. They supported the French when they were fighting against their African colonies. And the same situation in Southeast Asia. France had colonized Vietnam. And of course, after World War II, the French wanted to reclaim their colonies. and the United States assisted them to do so. The French were defeated. Then the United States came in and tried to subdue Vietnam, and they were defeated as well, totally in 1975. So it's a pattern of attempted imperialist domination that is starting to fade right now. And I think this is a reflection of the somewhat paranoia that the United States has vis-a-vis Africa and other geopolitical regions of the world. For example, Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, was in Senegal over the weekend. She was in Zambia yesterday. Ambassador Greenfield from the United Nations has also paid a recent visit to the African continent. They're deliberately trying to run interference and to trying to poise as if they are an alternative to China and the Russian Federation. I think most people on the continent realize not only the foreign policy of the United States is not in their interest, but if they look at the domestic situation inside the United States, vis-a-vis racism, national oppression, domestic turmoil that exists here in this country, many people around the world are starting to see the United States for exactly what it is. It is a declining empire, and it's going to eventually collapse.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, well, a pretty stark prediction there for the U.S. I couldn't help but notice, Eva Freeman, that you mentioned AFRICOM on a couple of occasions when you were speaking with the questions that I asked. And a quick Google search on AFRICOM doesn't have very favorable readings and overviews on the function of AFRICOM, even from the get-go when it was established back in 2007, from what I'm reading over here, or from what I read. It said that it was not welcomed by Africa, that African countries had lots of question marks in terms of its activities. And if you want to take just an overview of how it has functioned, it hasn't functioned that well. When you take a look at, obviously, the insurgency that is still prevalent in certain African countries, what is the function of AFRICOM and the necessity that the U.S. saw to form it in the first place?
Mm-hmm. So, well, the function of AFRICOM, I would like to go to the quote from the General Robert Mueller, was the first one of the first commanders of AFRICOM, who said the function, one of the guiding principles of AFRICOM, and it's somewhat of a paraphrase, but I'm pretty close
to
the exact words. The guiding principles of AFRICOM is to guarantee the free flow of minerals to the global market, and that's from Africa to the global market. And so that's basically the function of it, even though right now they try to, you know, couch it in other more altruistic purposes, like fighting terrorist extremism, violent extremism, and things like that. But then we can see over the time that they actually are the cause, you know, the United States caused it, particularly with their first AFRICOM operation, the U.S.-led NATO destruction of Libya, which, you know, scattered, you know, jihadists and weapons across the continent, and we also see them in stirring up things where the continued suffering in Somalia, where they've been sustaining a drone war against the people in Somalia, and all you have to do. I mean, of course, there are formations like Al-Shabaab, but then the United States says that they claims that they're preserving innocent lives with. You know, there's a lot of questions about that, and all they have to do is call somebody a militant, then their life is, you know, when they kill people, it's not thought of.
Sure.
When we think about the other African leaders and other people, they see these contradictions. So to look at then say why you should not be supporting Russia, but then the United States can go around the world and mm-hmm. cause all kinds of death and destruction, and even a military cooperation. I'll just end with this: with Russia, has a lot to do with the failure of AFRICOM and even the French to do what they say is to fight violent extremism.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the French, because that's my next question here. So, Abiy, we're taking a look at what happened with France and Burkina Faso. I'm sure you're aware of that, which is somewhat similar to what happened to France in Mali, though might not be similar, but the end result was France was, I don't want to use the word kicked out, but was pushed out of those two countries, okay? Why is it that this is happening? I mean, to put it into context for us, for example, with AFRICOM, one thing that has been stated is that the U.S. military goes into these countries and aligns itself militarily because it wants to move its foreign policy for those countries to follow its foreign policy. Is that what we're looking at when it came to France? Because this overall looks like African countries are pushing Western countries out, because we understand that now Russia might be coming into Burkina Faso to help with its security needs.
Yes, when Ibrahim Traore took over several months ago, there were large-scale demonstrations in Burkina Faso, not just in the capital of Ouagadougou, but in other areas of the country. And when people were demonstrating, they attacked French diplomatic and economic installations, and many of the people in the crowds were flying Burkinabe flags, but they were also flying Russian flags because they were requesting security assistance from the Russian Federation. We've seen a similar situation in Mali, where French troops claim they have withdrawn their forces from Mali, and also in Guinea as well, because Guinea underwent a military coup during 2021 as well. And there, of course, they are a former French colony. But it's interesting to see how the people who have been involved in these coups have undergone training in United States war colleges, and they've also engaged in joint military maneuvers with the AFRICOM forces. So this shows the contradiction of U.S. foreign policy in Africa, because some of the same people who they were considering as allies are now turning against U.S. Involvement and French involvement in Africa.
So you're saying that they've gone and they've trained in the U.S. through AFRICOM, and then they've come back and they've realized their mistake, and now they're working against the U.S. Altogether? Did I understand you correctly?
Yes, in France as well. For example, Doumbouya, Mamadou Doumbouya, who took over in Guinea during 2021, had been involved heavily with United States military forces as well as French military forces. The similar situation that has taken place in Mali. Several coup leaders have been trained inside the United States, and now they're realizing that the French so-called security assistance and U.S. security assistance is ineffective. That these rebel groups, many of whom, in my assessment, are backed directly or indirectly by the United States and France, they have not been able to be curtailed. So you have a very precarious security situation in a number of these Sahelian countries, and this pattern is following through other areas of the African
continent. So my final question that comes based on just what our guest there said, Netva Freeman, the African countries cannot trust the U.S. then, which is why when it comes to South Africa, it being a member of BRICS, they're shifting, not shifting, but they want to progress in that sphere, not in gravitating towards the U.S., but moving in a BRICS formation, for example, which involves Russia and China. And this therefore represents not a shift, but a movement towards the East that's been in motion for some time. Is that correct? Under a minute, please.
Yeah, that's correct. I think all China and even Russia represent an alternative to the West that doesn't strap them with such coercion and naked exploitation of the countries. And that also the people, I mean, I think the leadership in Africa, because it's plain to see that the history of the U.S. in Africa is fraught with things that should tell them they can't be trusted. The assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the overthrow of Kwame Nkrumah, I mean, this goes pretty far back. And even now, they can see, you know, they're destroying countries like Libya. And so any relationship that presents an alternative that's much more respectful and bilateral is a plus.
Thank you very much for that, Netva Freeman, coordinating committee member at Black Alliance for Peace from Washington, D.C. Abiyomi Ezekiwe, thank you so much. Editor at the Pan-African Newswire from Detroit. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Ikova Tahwe and the team. It's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, women's legal right on husband in the Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the women's legal rights on the husband in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic teachings, it is necessary upon the man or the husband to pay the dowry to the wife. And it has been necessary because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made this money for the wife, that after the marriage, if she wants to spend it in any place where she wants to buy anything, or she wants to enjoy the money that she has got after the marriage, she could do that, and she should not be waiting for the husband to maybe pay something to her. Therefore, Allah has made this necessity upon the man to give or pay the dowry to the wife after the marriage. Another responsibility or the right of the woman is that it is necessary for the man to provide the security in the family. He must provide the security. The family must be secure. The place where they're living must be secure. So she feels secure when she's living with her husband. She must feel secure at the place where she's living. As per the wealth or the money, as per the life, she must feel secure. She must not feel insecure in financial terms. She must not feel insecure in the terms of life, or she must not feel that she is in the danger. Therefore, it is necessary upon the husband to provide the security to the wife so that she can have a peaceful life living with him, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We'll be talking about the topic of the woman's legal right on the husband in the Islamic lifestyle. Now, one of the other rights of the woman is that the man or the husband must not lack of zeal. He must not lack of zeal. He must take care of his wife. He must not allow his wife to be in a place where everyone can see. Unfortunately, when I talk about the Western culture, the non-Islamic culture, today we see that the man likes his wife to basically put on makeup, put on the unethical clothes and go out. And he show off his wife to the people that, look how beautiful wife do I have, or the girlfriend, for example, like if we're talking about the non-Islamic culture. This is forbidden in Islam. The wife and the husband, they must adorn themselves for each other. The wife must adorn herself for the husband. Therefore, this lack of zeal will result in the corruption. You know, other people who are looking at someone's wife, who are looking at someone's, honor, at someone's zeal. So it is not permissible in Islam. Therefore, Islam says that the man must provide a secure place to the woman, and the man should show him being the man of the house. He should protect his wife from the sights of the people, from the gaze of the people, from the talks of the people, from any kind of insecurity in which she is uncomfortable, or where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said that this will bring disrespect for you. So if woman is in hijab, she's observing hijab, she's observing veil, that is a dignity or the respect for the woman herself. And it brings that dignity and respect for the husband as well. So therefore, it is necessary for the husband to secure his family from such consequences, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
When the term de-dollarization was coined, there was a concrete idea behind it, that the U.S. currency would be uncrowned someday. And when we talk about the U.S. decline, we cannot avoid talking about de-dollarization and the end of dollar hegemony in the world. Believe it or not, the world is going to be multipolar as world economies are exhausted by the U.S. military and financial bullying. So efforts are underway to topple the dollar. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, Brazil and Argentina are reportedly set to start work on creating a currency union that would eventually involve other nations on the continent. Brazil and Argentina plan to create a common currency, the Financial Times has reported recently, citing officials. The plan will be discussed and officially announced at a summit in Buenos Aires, according to the report. Argentina's economy minister Sergio Massa told the news outlet there will be a decision to start studying the parameters needed for a common currency, which includes everything from fiscal issues to the size of the economy and the role of central banks. According to Massa, other Latin American nations will be invited to join the common currency project. Brazil is proposing calling the new currency SOR, which translates as South. Massa noted the creation of the SOR is likely to take years, pointing to the fact that it took Europe 35 years to create the euro. It would be a study of mechanisms for trade integration. I don't want to create any false expectations. It's the first step on a long road which Latin America must travel, he said. Other officials who spoke to the news outlet said the new currency is expected to boost regional trade and help cut the country's reliance on the U.S. dollar. Brazil and Argentina have discussed the idea of a common currency for several years, but Brazil's central bank previously blocked efforts to get such an initiative off the ground, sources told the Financial Times. The two countries boast the largest economies in South America. Brazil is a member of the BRICS group and has enjoyed relative economic stability in recent years, although analysts point to a number of headwinds that could dampen growth this year. Argentina, meanwhile, has been plagued by economic instability for decades. The country has defaulted on its debt several times, most recently in 2020, and has had to resort to capital controls to protect its currency. Inflation in the country is currently soaring, and it has a roughly $40 billion debt to the IMF. Meanwhile, modern diplomacy had an eye on this issue. The de-dollarization, writing the West's primary point of concern, should be Russia and China's recent commitment to de-dollarize their transactions and establish a financial bubble immune to Western sanctions, notes the National Interest. There is a tendency in the West to discount Russian projects that supply the country with enough funds to make it to the next month, but cannot realistically last for an extended period of time. The problem with this mindset, though, is that Russia has no intention of reverting back to its participation in the U.S.-led international system, since it is convinced that China holds the future. Just as Putin demanded that European companies pay for Russian oil and gas in rubles or gold at the beginning of the year, he has also pressed Chinese energy firms to pay for gas in ruble or yuan. Russian banks have begun issuing checking and savings accounts in Chinese yuan. Russian Finance Minister Anton Silonov said during an interview, purchases of currencies of unfriendly countries, primarily dollars and euros, are now impossible. For us, these currencies are toxic. When asked why Russian assets in dollars and euros are still accumulating abroad if Moscow intends to dissolve all links to these currencies, Silonov maintained that Russia is in the process of abandoning them before adding a curious line. The only options that remain for Russia are ruble, a currency that we trust, or imports that are of our interest. Moscow has made its greatest strides toward de-dollarization domestically, however, and this initiative is inextricable from its coercive natural resource diplomacy. For instance, major fuel and oil companies are planning to increase the use of yuan in their operations. Reports say in August 2022, Russians bought a record number of the Chinese currency after Beijing doubled the yuan ruble trading band in March to provide more flexibility in currency exchanges. Putin said that Russia will not give up the dollar, but will instead dramatically reduce its shares.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Ukrainian officials took part in a meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday via video link. An additional 500 million euro military aid package for Kiev was confirmed, but the EU is at pains to point out that's just a drop in the ocean compared to what the bloc has already provided since last March.
Keep in mind the figure of 49 billions is the total amount of support to Ukraine, military, financial, economic, and humanitarian.
Just a few days ago in the European Parliament, the strategy was condemned.
It's militarism that's driving a dramatic rise in geopolitical tensions, drastically undermining our security. And you'd think that the Ukraine war would have shocked us out of this approach, but no.
Workers have taken to the streets of Brussels to demand peace negotiations.
We need to stop this war because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation.
EU foreign ministers adopted a fresh round of sanctions against Iran on Monday over alleged human rights abuses. The grounds for such sanctions are vehemently rejected by Tehran. Critics say the West's policy towards Russia and Iran is being driven by Washington. Moscow and Tehran control the largest energy reserves in the world. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Also on Monday, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh updated EU foreign ministers on the appalling situation in the occupied territories. There was absolutely no discussion on the EU side regarding possible sanctions against Israel. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The United States suffered its worst mass shooting in nearly a year when a gunman killed 10 and wounded 10 others in California. In the nation's third largest city of Chicago, at least 30 people were shot and 7 killed over the weekend, illustrating how routine gun violence has become across the country. The California gunman showed symptoms of paranoia and mental illness, But for the last 40 years, liberal economic measures have gutted not only health services, but sent jobs overseas, eliminated anti-poverty measures, and fostered a climate of perpetual instability and insecurity.
People feel like it is every person for themselves. And for some people, then the answer to that is going to be, yeah, it's worth the risk. It's worth the, you know, it's worth taking the steps to engage in, you know, I don't know, theft, carjackings, breaking into homes, you know, and ultimately, you know, you're going to have certain situations with that will create, you know, instances of gun violence and murder.
Last year saw almost double the number of mass shootings compared with just 4 years ago. In 2022, death rates from firearms reached their highest level in three decades. For many big city mayors, even Democratic ones, more cops is the answer. However, anti-police sentiment has exploded, most recently at a protest in Atlanta against yet another killing by police, and many say more militarism just isn't the solution.
Real community safety measures, which does not mean more police within the neighborhoods, but actually means going through building real community bases of support that lean in the direction of violence prevention, but ultimately that can't be separated out from the real needs, you know, of housing, healthcare, education that working people face on the daily.
Following the California massacre, a congressman said that mass shootings are a uniquely American experience. With the termination of many coronavirus-era assistance programs and another recession on the horizon, few expect that such experiences will decrease. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago. United States President Joe Biden has just reached the halfway mark of his term, and perhaps the best word to sum up the past 2 years is a new phrase, polycrisis, which is defined as the simultaneous creation of several catastrophic events. Most of them started with foreign policy. Biden totally backtracked on his promise to re-enter the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy agreement, and then charged into exacerbating the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Sanctions on Russia have backfired so badly that the average family has lost over a month's salary since Biden took office, or $7,400. Biden came to power with total control of Congress, thanks to big campaign promises of rebuilding after the devastation of the coronavirus lockdowns.
The Build Back Better plan that was supposed to give you all these, you know, workers' rights, it was supposed to, like, you know, put so much money into infrastructure, it was supposed to improve the education system. Barely any part of the Build Back Better plan made it past legislation.
Biden's approval rating is currently the lowest of his presidency at just 40%. The Democrats lost control of the lower House of Representatives in the midterm elections due to widespread disillusionment. The country now faces 2 years of congressional dysfunction, and many wonder if the progressive spirit of 2020 can be recaptured.
Every time Republicans have control, they will use whatever power they can, little or a lot, to get what they want passed. Whenever Democrats are in charge, whatever the Republicans left them, they'll cling on to it no matter how far, you know, right it advanced. And so the strategy here is, it's bipartisan if you look at the big picture. The Republicans move things right, they take away all these social and civil liberties, and the Democrats, when elected, preserve just exactly where they are so that when the Republicans win again, they can move them further right.
Record inflation, another recession, a divided Congress, and no end to forever war. The Biden era can't be defined by just one crisis. A recent poll found that 60% of Democrats don't want Biden to run for re-election in 2024. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Afghanistan is witnessing its coldest winter in 15 years, adding to the misery of millions who are already struggling with multiple crises. Umar Khan, a Kabul resident and a father of seven, lives in a cold shack. two of his children are severely sick. Without a job and relief assistance, he has been unable to afford food, heating, and medication for his family. The situation has triggered fears of human losses.
As I told you, this son of mine collects plastic bottles and waste for one-time heating during the day. I was unemployed almost the entire year, and I couldn't afford fuel or winter clothes for my children. This other son is suffering from the disease of kidney stones. In such a situation, I'm afraid my children may go undernourished or freeze to death. This is a catastrophic moment, and I'm wondering what to do.
Meanwhile, the United Nations has put Afghanistan on its list of 11 crisis hotspots in 2023. The UN survey shows that two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, over 28 million people, need humanitarian aid. Heads of households, like Shah Gul, say they can't cope with the harsh winter alone.
We can't afford more than one meal per day. We used to buy some loaves of bread and potatoes, but today they're also gone from the table. We're not living a life in this cold room with no blanket or enough clothes. When the Taliban took power, everyone was saying that Afghanistan is going to see peace. But what about jobs, earning an income, and food? We need the Taliban administration and aid groups to reach out to us before we die from hunger or cold.
This comes as major aid groups have suspended their missions following the Taliban's ban on female workers. For many Afghans, the services provided by the NGOs were a lifeline that has been removed at the worst possible moment. Afghanistan is grappling with economic, political, and human rights crisis. Experts said the Taliban administration's restrictive measures, coupled with Western sanctions, are worsening the situation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Of high school students have hit the streets of the Italian capital to rally against what they call the school system in grave decay at the service of companies and private interests. The protest took aim at a 2015 school reform named the Good School by then Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. The reform radically transformed the Italian education system, introducing measures including granting more powers to principals, a new national recruitment process for teachers, and obligatory work experience programs for high school students.
The 2015 reform brought private interests into our schools. From that year onwards, the company's interests came first, not our preparation. The rat race had just begun.
The reform has legalized the exploitation of us students. We are obliged to work unpaid for businesses. It's completely useless and unfair.
Students at the rally said the initiative was also called to remember Lorenzo Parrelli, an 18-year-old boy who was crushed by a metal bar while on a school training placement at a factory in northern Italy a year ago.
Lorenzo was assassinated by the work placement program. He was working in a factory for free, with no safety measures in place. Two more people have died under that program and simply in the interest of the capitalistic economy.
Recently, an international family caused a stir by saying they had to leave Italy due to the appalling conditions of the education system. While schools vary around the country, statistics show that educational standards overall are consistently below the EU average.
Italy is the country in the European Union that invests the least in public education. According to data by the European Statistical Agency Eurostat, Italy allocates about 8% of its public spending in this field, placing it last after Greece and well below the EU average of about 10%. Max Civili, Rome.
Women scientists and cultural and high-ranking political figures from 28 countries across the globe gathered in the Iranian capital, Tehran, to celebrate the efforts and achievements of women worldwide in a conference dedicated to women of influence. the first of its kind, an initiative of Iran's First Lady, Jamileh Alam-ul-Hoda, based on what used to be a ceremony limited to Iranian women in previous years. The conference was aimed at showing appreciation for women of influence while offering support and help for them to grow and promote their ideas, as Ensia Khazali, Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs, stated in her opening remarks. With Anna Hakopian, the wife of Armenia's prime minister, emphasizing the important role women play in promoting tolerance and peaceful coexistence. About 300 foreign guests are taking part in this conference, 70 of them female officials and politicians. The conference itself is held in three different levels: cultural, scientific, and a special panel for ministers and first ladies. Morning and afternoon sessions were held to provide a platform for the participants in order to share their ideas and valuable experiences regarding the challenges that women face in today's world. The conference wrapped up with Iran's First Lady thanking her guests for supporting the initiative and a special ceremony where the Goharshad Prize was awarded to seven of the influential women, recognizing their outstanding performance and contributions. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Already in 2023, 30 refugees have drowned in the Mediterranean Sea as they attempted to reach the EU, according to figures from the United Nations. The EU's border and coast guard agency, Frontex, has in the past been lambasted for pushing back unsafe boats, resulting in deaths. On Thursday, the new head of the agency vowed to end this practice.
I am responsible for the fact that my people don't participate in anything called a pushback. So I think that is absolutely clear. That is the legal framework I work in. So that's it.
According to OLAF, the EU's anti-fraud office, at least 2,000 refugees drowned in the Aegean Sea during 2020 and 2021 as they were pushed back from the EU coastline by Frontex. The agency prevented at least 40,000 asylum seekers from reaching the EU, which blatantly breaks international law. In just 10 months, the EU has welcomed more than 4 million Ukrainian refugees. They are afforded all the same rights as EU citizens. However, if you're from a different part of the world, torn up by Western powers, it's a different story. We visited a shelter for Afghans in Brussels.
Before we come in the Europe, we think the Europe care about women, care about children. Now we come in here, not. They don't care about women, they don't care about children.
When the children go to school, they need food, they need clothes. And for everything, we need to work. So we need the job permit.
There are no such problems for Ukrainians. Of course, that's to be welcomed, but rights groups are asking why the discrimination. EU Home Affairs ministers will meet in Stockholm, Sweden next Thursday to agree on a more effective strategy to deport asylum seekers who don't meet refugee status criteria. Campaigners point out there are no plans to adopt a similar policy for refugees arriving here from Western Ukraine, arguably a relatively safe region. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Could the UK witness a renewed push by religious communities to remove a controversial relationship and sex education, also known as RSE lessons, in British schools? It appears the appetite is huge after an online petition on the UK government website rocketed to well over 130,000 signatures in just a few days.
The petition focuses on tackling just one aspect of RSE, which many parents find concerning, LGBT relationship education, which is a lifestyle not condoned by the three Abrahamic faiths. However, there is a growing anti-RSE movement, which is campaigning for the total removal of RSE from the state curriculum, as activists believe that it is parents who should be teaching their kids about this sensitive subject matter rather than state-funded teachers.
RSE is currently mandatory in British schools, teaching kids about relationships and sex education, including same-gender relations. The lessons have been marred with controversy, sparking Muslim-majority parent protests as far back as 2019. Parents alleged their kids were being indoctrinated by secular worldviews
and what they call LGBT propaganda.
We believe that, you know, that the subjects, they should be able to withdraw from this type